the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in.
And joining us today is Matthew Bishop, attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center, here to talk about wolverines and their protection under the Endangered Species Act, or lack thereof, I guess.
Yeah.
Matthew, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Oh, Matthew, are you there? Let's see. There. Matthew, are you
Let's
there?
Let's try this.
Yeah.
Can Hi. You, yeah, I can hear you fine.
Ah, perfect.
Perfect.
Thanks
perfect.
For joining us. Go ahead now. Yeah. Reintroduce
All right,
Matt,
so we'll kind of
sure
we'll reset
that.
The stage here. So this is Matthew Bishop, an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center, here to talk about wolverines and their protection under the Endangered Species Act. Matthew, so thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Sure, yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the Endangered Species Act and the status of wolverines, let's start with this. Give us a little profile of this species and their habitat.
Well, wolverines are probably best described as sort of an animal that's custom built for sort of cold, snowy climates, and really a relic of the last ice age. Everything about them is sort of custom built for living in snow and colder environments. So they have a double fur coat, and the external coat is frost resistant. They have large feet that spread their weight across the snow, and large claws, crampon style claws, that allow them to dig and climb in the snow. And over the last, I guess, say 10 years, we learned a lot more about wolverines. There wasn't a lot known about them because they are typically live in more remote areas, sometimes higher elevations, and there's less encounter with humans. But over the last 10 plus years, we've learned a lot more about wolverines, thanks in part to some of the studies that took place in Glacier National Park, and putting GPS collars on wolverines and tracking where they go and documenting where they den and what they eat and where they spend their time.
They have massive ranges, right?
They do. Yeah, they cover a lot of ground, and that's something they learned after the Glacier Project. And it varies by area. So the home range in Glacier Park, for instance, would be very different from the boreal forest range up in northern Alberta. And here in the lower 48 in the west, we're really at sort of the southern tip of their range. They're more prevalent up in Alaska and Canada. But historically, you know, we did have wolverines throughout the mountains region of the west, including parts of Utah, Colorado, you know, Wyoming, the Sierras in California, and then obviously the Cascades and large portions of the Northern Rockies.
Well, Matt, last week I mentioned on the show that we've received some alleged sightings of wolverines here in Park City, Summit County, years ago.
Right.
And we realize this is a long shot, but we like to think maybe one passed through our town here. made a detour from the Uintas.
Well,
so you mentioned their presence in the West. Can you give us a sense of, you know, now there may be a few hundred, what would it have looked like at a peak or at their maximum?
Yeah, that's a great question. No one really knows historically what the occupancy was of wolverines in the West. There were a lot more wolverines, as I said, in Canada and Alaska. And in the West, you know, they did model wolverine habitat back in 2013 throughout the West. And the estimate for what the historic occupancy was ranges from, you know, the high 600s up to 1800 or so, based on available habitat estimates. Like a lot of other carnivores in the West, including grizzly bears, wolves, lynx, they were heavily trapped back in the late 1800s, and so it's hard to know. There are some records, obviously, of wolverine throughout the West, including in Utah, but it's hard to know what the historic numbers were precisely. Right now, they estimate, and again, it's just an estimate, the best guess based on available habitat and what little surveys have been done, they estimate the population in the lower 48 is probably around 300. And of that, the effective population, which is really an important concept, in biology, is which is really the number of wolverines that's able to contribute to the next generation could be anywhere from, you know, 30 to 40 or 50. So relatively small numbers. And right now they live in relatively small, increasingly isolated subpopulations in the West that are becoming less and less connected to one another. And that's one of the threats to the species, is as we see climate change and warming climate and decreased snowpack, the population itself is becoming more fragmented and isolated. And that's a concern that the biologists are expressing with respect to wolverine.
Okay, and that's interesting because a spokesperson or a scientist, biologist with the U.S. Forest Service was quoted as saying, "We expect there to be enough snow where they need it at the time of year they need it." And again, this is a biologist with the U.S. Forest Service agency. Wolverines are thought to depend heavily on snow, in large part because females normally give birth in dens they dig in snowbanks. So the U.S. Forest Service or Fish and Wildlife, anyway, the government agency that places denial thinks that, I guess the populations are sustainable at 200 or 250, and that it doesn't rise to the level of being listed as part of the on the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah, and that's, I think, you know, we disagree with that assessment. Okay. I'm personally not a biologist. I'm a lawyer with a history major, but we work closely with biologists and we review all the scientific literature, including the peer review that's done on the wolverine science. And we think it comes to a different conclusion, which is, yes, they're right that the study they rely on talks a lot about how there will be continuing snowpack in areas like Glacier Park, parts of Montana, or in the Tetons, or even Rocky Mountain National Park. That might be sufficient for wolverine. We don't know for sure, but that's a very small percentage of the wolverine's range. I mean, there are huge swaths of Idaho, for instance, in the Frank Church Wilderness up in the Panhandle, where the climate projections are predicting significant decreases in snowpack. And some of the science that's emerged in the last 5 or 6 years suggests the snowpack declines in the West could be significant, up to 60% in some areas. So from our position, we know that wolverine depend on snow. We don't fully understand the entire life history of wolverines and snow. We know they rely on deep, persistent spring snow for denning. And we know that there's going to be a decrease in snowpack and a contraction of the range. And we think that's sufficient enough to warrant them for listing, because the definition is whether or not they're likely to become endangered into the foreseeable future. So you're projecting out. And the agency, the Fish and Wildlife position is, well, there's just too much uncertainty about that. We know we're going to have some snow in these areas. And we need to fully understand how wolverine are going to respond to climate change. And we think that's just raising the bar too high for this species. And the approach really should be more of the precautionary principle, which is, let's protect them now. Do what we can within our means to protect their habitat and individuals. And then if it turns out we're wrong in the future, you can always delist. So we think they're taking the wrong approach here. And we think the science really points towards the species being in big trouble,
so
especially beyond, you know, next 30, 40 years.
Yeah. So let's dig into kind of this legal battle that's going on right now. In 2016, a federal judge sided with the Western Environmental Law Center and the conservation groups you represented, agreeing that their 2014 decision not to list wolverine as threatened was, I think, arbitrary and capricious. And so now this reverses that. Is that right?
Yeah, so in 2016, a federal court in Montana agreed with us that the agency was not applying the best available science, and that's really the legal standard. Under the Endangered Species Act, decisions can't be political. They have to be based on science. And in that case, you know, it's hard. You know, the judges are very deferential to agencies because in a lot of ways they are the experts, right? They're the scientists. So a federal judge is not going to second guess the agency on issues of science unless they really got it wrong. And I guess on this case, they really did, because all the peer-reviewed scientific papers were pointing in one direction, that the species was in trouble, the agency reversed course and, from our perspective at least, made a largely political decision not to list. The judge sent it back to the agency to make another determination, to review the science and review the findings again, and that's what they did, and they came back with the same decision. And that's why we're going back to court, unfortunately. I was hoping we were going to see a different outcome and we'd see protections for the species and then start working and spending our time and energy on designating critical habitat, preparing a recovery plan, exploring reintroduction of wolverine into areas like Utah, the Uintas, or the Wasatch, and in Colorado. Those types of efforts, as opposed to being back in litigation once again. This is not where we want to be.
So the timing of this decision is interesting, and I had to ask, you know, this coincides with kind of the presidential election. Do you think this has any relationship to that?
Well, it's hard to say. It's hard to predict. I do think this decision and the timing of it, along as we're anticipating a decision on lynx, the same decision on lynx, gray wolves. We saw a similar decision on Yellowstone grizzly bears. I also work on Mexican wolves in Arizona and Sonoran Desert tortoises. We're seeing a pattern here, which is, I guess, what I classify as a war on science. And this is just another chapter in that. The agency's wanting, this administration, the agency's wanting to make more political decisions and not in turn turns a blind eye towards the peer review papers and research and not listening to their own biologists. Because ultimately, that's what we're relying on in this case, is the agency's own biologist and their own peer review process. It's not like we have our own scientists and it's a battle of the expert situation. We think all the peer review literature, including the studies the agency itself relies on, all support listing in this particular case.
Wow. That is interesting and surprising.
Yeah.
We got another minute or so. Let's say the administration changes next week. Will that have any bearing on your efforts and this decision?
Well, my hope is that if that does occur, that the new administration will take a look at some of these decisions that were issued this year and maybe the previous year, including a lot of the issues I work on with respect to Mexican wolves, Canadian lynx, grizzly bears, and go back and reassess and apply the science and reevaluate its decision and hopefully come to a different outcome. That would be our preference, but it's impossible to predict.
Okay.
What will happen.
So if these species, you know, the lynx or the wolverine, were given protection under the Environmental Species Act, what would the implications of that be? How would that play out as far as climate change specifically?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's so tricky is it's hard to predict. I mean, these species might be in trouble and moving north. I guess from my perspective is we should be doing everything we can to conserve them here in the West. They're iconic species. They belong in the landscape. They play an important role in our ecosystems. And let's do what we can to protect the species. So federal listing in particular funnels a lot of federal money and attention to a particular species and triggers all sorts of tools or requirements to bring the species back to recovery. So I mentioned earlier designating critical habitat, which is areas that are critical to the species survival, preparing a recovery plan, which is really a roadmap for how to get to the numbers up and reconnect populations and how best to do that. Other things like consultation and prohibitions. There might be some restrictions on, say, for instance, certain types of motorized use in denning habitat, or restrictions on, say, trapping in areas that we know are important for wolverine. Because wolverines have a tendency to, they're scavengers. They go everywhere and eat everything, and they get in a lot of trouble in traps. We've seen some populations blink out here in Montana because of trapping. There are small little restrictions like that would really help the species along. And so the idea is to do everything we can, and hopefully we can turn around the climate change scenario such that wolverines, you know, will still have some places to live here in the lower 48.
Well, Matt, we have to start to wrap up here, but I want to ask, you know, if listeners are interested in getting involved in this issue or if they're interested in learning more, where can they find you?
Well, they can find my organization, the Western Environmental Law Center, online at www.westernlaw.org. And there are a lot of resources online, too, with respect to wolverine. Patagonia published a fantastic book by Douglas Chadwick a few years ago called The Wolverine Way, about the Wolverine and the research in Glacier, and it's a great read, and I'd highly recommend that as well, you know, if you have an interest in the species.
Well, I have to add that we interviewed Doug Chadwick on That's this screener. Right. So if you want to go back in the archives, you can find an interview with him, too.
Right? He's a great storyteller.
Yes.
And spends a lot of time in the field. So, yeah, he's a great resource.
Yeah.
Matt Bishop, he's an attorney with the Western Environmental Law Center. Thanks again, as always, Matt, for the work you do and joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Hey, thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.